This is an ABC podcast.
Wesley Enoch with you today, and my guest is Isaac Adams. As a boy growing up in Brisbane, Isaac Adams always knew he wanted to be a soldier. His dad had been in the army, and his Dutch grandmother, his oma, had been a prisoner of war, liberated by the Anzacs during World War II. At 18, Isaac signed up to join the army. He flew through basic training at Kapuka and became an aerial surveillance operator, flying drones as well. At 21, he got the news that he was going to Afghanistan. He returned a completely changed person. Within 2 years, suffering terribly from PTSD and hypervigilance, Isaac left the Defence Force for good. It took a new kind of therapy, helping ex-racehorses adjust to life off the track, to help him find a path to healing. G'day, Isaac. Thanks for joining us.
G'day. How you going?
Yeah, good, mate. Did you have a lot of animals around you when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. So I had a German Shepherd, and Dad had his German Shepherd, and I had chickens and ducks and birds and things like that. So I had, yeah, quite a lot of animals in my childhood.
Well, was this on a farm or something? Or?
Yeah, so we lived on an acre and a half. But, yeah, we had a few animals on there. Yeah.
And so your dad had a German Shepherd.
Yep.
And you had a German Shepherd.
Yeah.
What a puppy was it all?
Yeah, so when I was 8, I was bugging my parents. I wanted my own dog. So Dad had a German Shepherd that he'd trained up. I think he was about 6 or 7 at that stage. And, yeah, so they took me down and I picked a puppy, and then I started learning how to train a dog. So that was pretty cool.
When you say train a dog, are these working dogs that you're with?
Or? Yeah, so the Dad had still has like quite an eye for working line German Shepherds. So they're generally imported from Germany or that sort of bloodline. And these are the sort of dogs that you see in the police force and in security and corrections and stuff like that.
This is a big thing for an 8-year-old.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Like a pretty, you know, ferocious dog it could be too, I guess.
Yeah,
if it needed to be.
They got a bit of an ability there. Yeah. I remember Dad trained my dog, so she was pretty much ready to go with as far as like complete obedience training. There was no attack training with her. She was just, you know, my companion, so to speak. But Dad said, all right, you know, you can go and do some obedience. I was pretty interested in doing some obedience stuff at a school, like a class. And so I went down and I went from the beginner's class to the advanced class in about 10 minutes. I just sort of went into the beginners and they looked at me and said, nah, mate, keep going, go to the next class. Went to that class, that was intermediates. And they went, nah, mate, your dog's beyond this, go to the next class. And I got up to the advanced class and I was like, the dog knows what to do, but I don't know what to do. So they were like, oh, if you move here and do this, and then bang, my dog would do it. And I was like, still don't know how I got that, but we'll go with that. But, you know, I was sort of more about the connection I had with the dog. So then I sort of lost interest in classes or competitions and stuff. It was just about how I communicated with a dog.
And this idea of style, how would you kind of talk about your father's style of training then?
You know, it's funny. A lot of it was about me. And I remember very, very well, because it happened with me again in horses, where Dad was giving me a lesson with my dog. And so I'd come home from school and he'd say, you know, do you want to do some work with your dog? And I'd go, yeah, cool. So we'd go out in the backyard and I'd start doing some obedience stuff. And I couldn't get her to, I think it was a halt or a stay or something like that. And anyway, he said, all right, I'll show you. Because I started blaming the dog. So he started to show me what it was that he wanted, and it worked.
So it wasn't the dog's fault at
all. Yeah, so then I learned it was my fault. Well, it was my influence, so to speak. So, yeah, that by style, I think a lot of it was the responsibility. He took a lot of responsibility, and that was something that he imparted on me was, you know, your dog's as good as you. So, yeah.
Talked about this idea of responsibility. I mean, as an 8-year-old, you have the responsibility of this puppy.
Yeah.
Is that something your father wanted to teach you?
Yeah, I think it was. You know, I've spoken to my parents actually not that long ago about it because I'm expecting my first son in a couple of months. And so, yeah, it's interesting when you relook at your childhood and some of the lessons that your parents imparted on you. And I think responsibility was a key lesson that my parents wanted to give me. And it's something that's really put me in good stead, you know, with the rest of my life. You know, my dog ended up weighing 52 kilos. And I think at that stage she weighed more than me. But, you know, it was also about that command and control was sort of like a, there was no size, you know, there was no, you know, it was about me taking leadership. So there's lots of little lessons that was in that dog handling that he was teaching me. So, yeah, it was deliberate. It was definitely deliberate.
Now, as a young boy, your parents actually go and buy you a car as well.
Yeah.
How old are you when you get the car?
You know, come to think of it, I think must have been around the same time. I remember it being about 8 and I got my German Shepherd on my 8th birthday. So it was about 8 or 9 years old. I wanted to have my own car to drive. Dad, when he got out of the army, he became a driving instructor initially before he became a driving examiner. And he had a car that was set up with dual controls. So he had a braking, accelerating stuff on the passenger side. So there's a photo of me as a 3-year-old standing on the driver's seat while he's driving on the left-hand side. And yeah, I learned how to steer a car when I was 3, and then I learned how to drive when I was 8. So,
do you remember the day he bought it for you? What did it feel like?
Yeah, it was amazing. We actually went down, hired a car trailer, and then we drove out to, I think it was near Darra, and there was a car that he had seen when he was doing his testing, driving around. He saw this car on the side of the road and thought, that car hasn't moved in a while. I reckon we could buy that. So we went down and offered the guy some money, and then we picked it up, loaded it up, and took it home.
What does it feel like when you're behind the wheel? Here we are, a young kid, and you're behind the wheel of a car, and none of your peers, none of your school classmates ever can do that.
Yeah.
What does that feel like?
It was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. You know, most kids were focused on the next push bike they were going to get, and I was focused on getting petrol for my car so I could keep driving it. It was unbelievable for a lot of the people, I think, and that gave me a real sense of pride, and I had a real passion for driving.
Now, you say your dad was in the army, and for a bit of your childhood he was there, and then he came out. Did he ever talk about that experience, being in the army?
Yeah, he did. He was very proud of his service, and he did 14 years, so it's a pretty significant time. He was in Armoured Corps, so he drove armoured cars. I enjoyed hearing stories of bush trips and time away that he would spend and lessons that he'd learn and experiences he had in the army. So I think that really influenced my passion and desire to serve.
He told you good things. Did he tell you some of the bad things as well?
Told me a lot of the good things. Yeah, like, you know, time away, he found that quite tough at times. Yeah. You know, but I think definitely ultimately the good outweighed the bad.
Now, the army also plays a role in your mother's family's story as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so interestingly, mum's brothers, some of them are still serving. They've done nearly 40 years service. So I have an uncle who is a squadron leader in the Air Force, and another one that's I believe he's a lieutenant colonel in the army. So they've both done a lot of service, and Omar's brothers were all in the, and her father were in the Dutch army.
So Omar being your
grandmother.
Your grandmother.
Yeah, mum's mum. So yeah, very strong military influence on both sides of my family. My uncles on both sides have served, and grandfathers.
And what's that about, do you think, in your family? I mean, obviously that's service to your country.
Yeah. I think a lot of patriotism and, you know, being a proud national sort of person, if that makes sense. You know, particularly from my Omar side of the family, my Omar and my Opa, because they were immigrants to Australia. They were very, and they'd seen a lot of war and things like that. They were very proud to be here, and they saw it as their way of giving back to this country that their son served. Yeah, and well, as you mentioned before, Omar and my opa were both prisoners of war in Indonesia to the Japanese, and those camps were liberated by the Australian Army, so they were very grateful.
And what was she like, your Omar?
Hard. Tough woman, very tough woman. The toughest woman I know, second to obviously my mother. Yeah, very strong-minded, very strong-willed, and extremely strict. I had some firm lessons from Omar when I was a young fella, just with responsibility again, and being disciplined. Self-discipline was massive to Omar, so yeah.
Well, let's jump forward now, and you're 18, you're leaving school. The first thought you have is, let's join the army.
Mm. Well, actually, I originally wanted to do a trade, but when I was a kid, I went through a stage in high school where I didn't actually think I had what it took to serve in the army. I just went through this period where I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I could do that.
What was that? Why was that a question?
I think because of the dedication to service and you know, the toughness, you know, the mental toughness and physical toughness to be a soldier. Yeah, I think to go back to it, I reckon that was probably what it really boiled down to. And so the challenge kind of excited me a little bit. So I went from wanting to do a trade to actually wanting to do a trade in the army.
You want to be a mechanic
in
the army?
Yeah, I want to be a mechanic in the army.
But what happens?
I had been offered, through testing, I'd been offered a couple of trades, mechanical apprenticeships outside of the army. And I thought, well, if I've got those, I'll get one when I'm in the army. So I went down and tried, and they came back to me and said, I'd passed all the medical and psych assessments and all that sort of stuff. They said, the job that you want to go for, you can't do it. And I said, oh, why? They said, oh, you didn't score high enough, but you can be a radar operator. And I thought, how's a radar operator not smarter than a mechanic? That doesn't make sense.
Well, how'd you feel about that, though? I mean, this is something you've really looked forward to, your whole family has an expectation.
I was sort of challenged by it, and I didn't know what to do. So I remember I was at Brisbane here, so I walked out, I phoned the old man, and I said, hey, listen, they've said I can't get in. And he said, no, you can get in. What it would be for the job? They probably want you to do a different job, because he obviously understood the system. And I said, oh. And so then we talked about it, and he said, well, why don't you just see if they can do a different intake for you? So that I'm sure maybe in 6 months' time you could come back and reapply, and you could get in and do your trade then. And I went straight in there, and I said, okay, if you don't have that job for me, what do you have? And they said, well, you've got these, and I said, these three different jobs. And I said, okay, which one leaves the soonest? And they said, this one, and it was operator radar.
Which one leaves the soonest?
Yeah, I wanted to go to Kapooka.
Straight away.
Yeah, and so they said, well, this operator radar, you leave in a month. And I said, right, I'll take that one.
So you're successful now.
Yeah,
you got a month, you're going off to Kapooka. Tell us about that little bus trip that you take.
Yeah, so we get on, a good mate of mine from that I'd gone to high school with, he drove me down to Brisbane and dropped me off, and you jump on a bus, and then we go from Brisbane here to the airport. And then you fly from Brisbane to Sydney. And then we get taken to the Holiday Inn in Sydney, in the middle of Sydney. And a lot of the other recruits from around Queensland and parts of New South Wales meet there, northern New South Wales. And it's actually where I met my best mate, who I'm still mates with today, in the foyer there. And he had these massive dreadlocks. And he was just walking towards me, and I thought, wow, that guy has got the biggest dreadlocks I've ever seen, and he's about to get them shaved off. And I thought it was quite funny. And, we just got talking, and you have dinner, and we're just chatting and talking about where we wanted to go. We realised that we're both going to go to the same unit. He was actually an operator UAV to start off with, whereas I was operator radar, but that operated out of the same regiment. So
does he know he's going to get his hair cut?
Yeah, he knew. He's a pretty funny character. He's a very happy-go-lucky sort of should-be-right sort of bloke.
Was he suited to the army as well?
Yeah.
What makes someone suited?
He's fiercely independent and a very very headstrong character, and he was just excited for a challenge, I think.
All right. Yeah. So you arrive there at Kapooka. What's the first things that are happening?
Yeah, so when we leave Sydney, we're going on a bus, and you sort of do southern New South Wales, and you head over to Wagga and then Kapooka. And the guy comes on, and this sergeant comes on and says, right, you're going to get off, grab your bag, carry it in your left hand, march into the hall, into this foyer, stand, like form up, and put your bag down by your left-hand side. And I picked it up in my right hand, put it over my shoulder, walked in, and I got screamed at. I just didn't listen closely enough. And so I quickly put my bag down by my left-hand side, and then they assign you to your platoon, and then you get given your sections that you're in. And that recruit instructor was my section commander. Got off on a good foot with her. And then, from there, they take you down to your lines where you live, and they assign you to your rooms, and you get your roommates. There's four of you in a room.
Tell us the story about those people who wanted to keep their hair.
Yeah, so as a joke, they sort of said to us, there's lots of little things that they do at Kapooka to see if you'll stand out. You know, you don't want to be the first person, you don't want to be the last person. That's kind of the mentality when you go through Kapooka. And they said, if you want to keep your hair, prove or put your hand up, and we'll help you. We can help you keep your hair. And so people are thinking, oh, I might be able to keep my hair. They won't shave my head off, because we all knew they were going to shave our heads. So a couple of blokes put their hands up, and the recruit instructor marched down and gave them a plastic bag and said, when they cut your hair off, you can put it in that and keep it. So that was sort of my first taste of, okay, don't put your hand up. just go with the flow. Don't stand out. Just do what you're told and keep your head down.
That's a hard thing. You, as an individual, you have to almost let that go away and be part of the group all the time. How did that feel for you?
I loved it. I didn't find the adjustment to Kapuka really difficult at all, and I think a lot of it was because of the like disciplined sort of way I was raised and my passion for being there. I really wanted to be there, so anything that was sort of asked, I was pretty keen to do it.
The first week, yep. You're given a uniform, you're given your section, you're told what to do. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was in 26 platoon in one section, and I had three other guys in my room, and we got all our kit, and you're starting to work out, you know, the process of everything and how it all works. You're a bit like a deer in the headlights, you know, they shave your head and then you sort of go into bed when they tell you to go to bed, waking up when they tell you to wake up. They yell out your platoon number and you'll have to come running out and pull your bed sheets off and lay them over your shoulders, and then they call out your hallway number to make sure everybody numbers themselves off to make sure everyone's got out of bed, and then you go on with your jobs.
Why do you have your sheets over your shoulders?
It's so that your bed's not made so that everybody has to make their beds and they inspect the way that you make your bed. So from that moment they wake you up, everyone numbers off, and then you got to go back into your rooms and make
your
bed.
There's a lot of yelling. Why is there so much yelling going on?
Yeah, so one, to teach you how to yell, but also how to do as you're told and respond to commands, but also it's to mimic the operational environment. If you're ever in a contact or, you know, there's bombs or things going off, shooting and things like that, you need to be able to confidently relay a message. So it's about you being able to hear something that's being said and you being able to relay that message back as well.
I mean, to be honest, the whole situation feels, well, maybe to the everyday person, a bit oppressive. It feels like it's really kind of holding you back. You seem to have enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe it wasn't for everyone. Did you have stories of people who didn't make it?
Yeah, so 52 of us marched into that platoon and only 26 marched out. Half the people didn't make it out of that platoon. They do different exams and tests and things like that throughout that you have to achieve, like competencies that you have to achieve. And if you don't pass those, then they will take you out of that platoon and then you'll get back squatted into another platoon to give you an opportunity to pass that competency again.
Did you find it that you were good at anything in particular?
Not really. Not really great at anything. It wasn't too terrible, but it wasn't too good either.
How did you get through then? How did you get through?
Oh, you know, you only have to pass things. It's not, you know, you don't have to be a star. You can just be fit enough to pass your fitness test, be good enough shot to pass your shooting test, and strong enough to complete a pack march, and that's it.
Were there stars though? I mean, it feels like it's something everyone wants to be good at.
Yeah. So at the end of the 90 days, there they have a best shot, best recruit, and fittest recruit. So there's a couple of people that are standouts in fitness or shooting or whatever like that. But it definitely wasn't me.
Now, the first operation you go on is to Saibai Island in the Torres Strait. What was that like? What were you doing there?
Yeah. So that was Op Resolute. We were doing a border protection task, so we were doing surveillance looking for illegal immigrants, drug smugglers and illegal fishing. And I got taken right up to Saibai Island, which is just off the coast of Papua New Guinea. And it was myself, another full-time guy who was a signaller, and four other guys that were from a reserve unit, infantry unit up in Cairns. We went up by boat and then we just sat off the coast a little bit of this island, and then when it went dark, we jumped on tinnies and did a night insertion, and then we had to live covertly on the island for about a month.
So the locals didn't know you even.
Yeah, no one could know that we were there, because obviously if they know we're there, they're going to choose a different path to get down to Australia. So, yeah, we lived on this island. It was a very good experience. I have great memories of it.
What are some of those memories?
Fishing. So we would just sneak out and the guys actually, so I had two indigenous guys that were in my section, and one was brand new and the other guy had a bit more experience. And so I was teaching the guy that was brand new how to wear shoes, because he was a complete islander. He'd never wore shoes before and he didn't usually wear a shirt. So wearing cams and wearing shoes was all new to him. And, that was really cool. But they taught me how to make a spear, out of bamboo, and we were picking coconuts and spearing fish and eating mud crabs and oysters, and it was awesome.
Sounds like paradise.
Yeah.
And so did you catch any drug dealers or?
Yeah, so I was on a shift one night and intercepted a guy traveling down Warrior Way with the radar that we were operating, and I contacted the Navy and they intercepted him with a patrol boat. And so there was a couple of ones that we intercepted during that operation, but that was one that I was a part of personally. And yeah, it felt good to be a part of something that was protecting Australia.
What's the level of concentration you need for the job?
When you're on shift, it's pretty high. But everyone sort of knows the importance of switching on and switching off and having downtime. So we would rotate through as a crew of six of us and take turns. So, yeah, a lot of focus and a lot of concentration required, yeah.
So your next operation in 2011, you get the message you're 21 and that you're going to go to Afghanistan. What did your mum and dad say when they knew you were going to go to Afghanistan?
Not much. If I'm honest, not much. They were both pretty quiet about it, and they knew how much it meant to me to go overseas and how much I wanted it. So they were just quiet. That's how I'd describe it, yeah.
Is that being supportive to be quiet like that?
Yeah, for sure. But also, you know, I think it's a bit apprehensive as a parent. I'm the only child. So, yeah, watching me go overseas would have been pretty tough.
And how quickly does it happen when you get the... You get the deployment notice, and how quick is it?
Yeah, so I was actually part of a reinforcement cycle. So interestingly, I had an idea that I was going, but I was waiting for my order to go. And it was a Monday, and it was 7 o'clock. This happened for a couple of weeks. I'd go in on Monday, 7 o'clock. Nah, it's not here. Go home, chill out, wait until it comes through. And then I got home 7:30. I got a phone call. It's here. You're going tomorrow. You know, get your stuff and off you go. So, yeah, it happened all quite quickly.
This is Conversations. On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Isaac, you've arrived at night. What were some of your first impressions?
It was kind of a surreal sort of experience because I got into country and my mate met me at the airport at the tarmac there, and I couldn't really see anything because it's pitch black. Obviously, there's not a lot of lights and stuff over there, only on the base. And so, yeah, it was sort of hard to work out where I was. You know, I was a little bit like, oh, what, you know, I can't see the terrain. So it was interesting.
When the light came up the next day, what did you see there?
Yeah, so the next day, it was pretty cool looking out and just seeing desert, but then there was like a green belt that sort of went through the middle of Afghanistan, or through TK, that is, green and trees, but then outside of that, it's just mountain and rock and sand. And also there was snow on the mountains were snow capped because I was there at the end of winter. So it was a really, snow and desert isn't something you put together, but it was a pretty interesting sort of experience.
And what's it sound like? Does it sound like home?
TK has a lot of aircraft coming and going. So you've got a lot of helicopters and C-130s taking off, and it's quite noisy in that respect. Where we were was right next to the airfield. So yeah, lots of, you know, vehicles coming and going, and quite dusty and windy at times.
And where's your place of rest? What are you sleeping in?
Yeah, so we had I guess you'd describe it a bit like a shipping container, and they were all stacked up. All the guys that I served with, we lived in there together in bunk beds and stuff.
And what did you do in your first week when you were there?
So the first week is really just reconnecting with everyone and getting familiarised with the base, and then just sitting in with other guys that were operating the unmanned aircraft around doing missions and just getting a familiarisation with how we operate and the area and landmarks and things like that.
Unmanned aircraft, I imagine it's a drone. How do you operate them? Where are you stationed?
You operate it from a computer. And there we had like a couple of screens and a joystick for the camera and things like that. So you operate from a building, basically, and we have antennas and stuff outside. So there's a couple of different ways you can control those aircraft, but predominantly that's how we were doing it.
That sounds like a video game. Like you're in a darkened room with a joystick and a screen.
I mean, yeah. I guess it would be a little bit like that. Or maybe if people are familiar with like a flight simulator, it's a bit like that.
And describe these drones, these craft. They're quite big, aren't they?
Yeah. So they have a wingspan of about 3 meters. They're pretty long.
And what's their purpose? What are you doing when you're operating them out there?
Our role varied, but a lot of it was looking over and watching the battle space sort of thing and giving eyes on. Because obviously, you know, with the way that warfare is sort of fought today, it's good for commanders to be able to see what's occurring on the ground. So a lot of our roles was that. We would also do a lot of intelligence gathering through observation again. So really the aircraft is just another surveillance platform.
And you're looking after patrols as well?
Yeah, we'd look after patrols. We'd do like what's called overwatch, just offering commanders another way to view what's going on, but also preventative stuff as well. We might see someone that's posturing to do something.
And how many hours a day are we talking about?
We would do a 12-hour shift.
12 hours of concentrating on the screen and the joystick.
Yeah, so we would generally swap out with our mates. So you might do, you know, I've done up to sort of 8 to 10 hours in one go, but generally you would go for, you know, 3 to 4 hours and then we'd rotate just so you stay fresh. And then you'd have like half an hour off and then you jump back on.
It's a lot of pressure though.
There's a lot of concentration required, yeah.
And what do you do to unwind in that situation?
My main one was the gym. Gym was my outlet. I loved going to the gym. Sometimes I'd go on my lunch break. A lot of times I'd go after my shift.
Are there any animals at TK, as you say, Tarenkaut?
There's actually hedgehogs.
Hedgehogs?
Yeah. I caught a hedgehog when I was there. And we had two pet tortoises that some guys had caught. And that they had a pen outside our where we lived. And one actually had a hole in his shell because he'd been hit by shrapnel. The Afghanis obviously had goats and sheep and
is it hard to form
stuff.
Relationships? I mean, I'm just thinking about these animals, these mascots, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you forming relationships?
So two of my best mates I served with, and the sort of environment that you're exposed to, it creates a very deep bond.
And this pressure cooker, I mean, I guess it's not for everyone, but it's really would be tough as well. A bit homesick, I imagine?
Yeah, you get a bit homesick. I think there is still a very strong sense of purpose and very strong sense of identity. And everybody over there is extremely proud to be there. So I think that overcomes a lot. The little setbacks or the little tough days that you have, you're pretty proud to be over there.
And how much contact were you allowed to have with home?
You could have as much contact with home as you like. I personally found it was probably better that you limit how much you contact home because you need to focus. You're in another world, and you know, I would describe it as being between two worlds, and it's a bit hard when there's stuff going on at home and you know that you're going to be here for at least 6 months or so.
When you're in that other world, in country as you say.
Yeah.
Do you think that you could ever say, look, I'm having a really bad day or I'm not coping at the moment, or was that something you had to kind of push down?
Good question. I don't know. I think we all experienced days where we were like, I don't know how much longer I can do this, or, you know, what am I doing here? This is really tough. But again, I think it was that amongst soldiers, it's kind of like, well, we're here fighting for our country. Yeah. So you need to.
Do you, in the back of your head, are you counting down the days?
Oh, we definitely counted down together. When we got to that last month, we were like, yeah, we're going to be out of here on this date. You know what I mean?
Did you have a moment when you went, actually, I'm not coping here today? And what happened to bring that on?
To be honest, yeah, I had that a couple of times. One time I was actually on the phone and then I heard the rocket incoming warning. And I thought, I think that's what it is, but I don't know what it is. And I said, oh, hang on a second. I put the phone down. I walked to the door and I opened the door. And sure enough, that's the noise. Now, most people would just keep running and find shelter. I ran back to go and hang up the phone. And then I turn around and I'm like, oh, I need to run out of this building. So I start running out of the building and I could hear the rockets coming, and one landed quite close to me, and I was sprayed with dirt and stuff, and shrapnel and stuff was flying past my head, and I was running to a building to run to, and a piece about the size of my fist punched a hole in the external, it was like a shed sort of thing, went straight through it. So it was that moment for me was a bit like, now things were quite real. And I found it a bit hard after that to sleep, just probably for about a week. I was sort of like, every time I heard that noise, I'd wake up. If I was sleeping, I'd wake up and just be sort of paranoid, I guess would be the word. Yeah. I was a bit paranoid about it. But yeah, it sort of subsided after a while. But that was sort of a moment for me where I was like, wow, this is real now. If we're going to talk about the PTSD, I think the biggest part that I struggled with was the moral injuries.
What's a moral injury?
What it is basically, you know, your moral values or your structures of who you are as a person, and then you're exposed to something that challenges you. For me, it was over that period of the time that I served in Afghanistan, being exposed to women and children getting hurt and civilians getting hurt and watching other American soldiers get killed and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, making connections with people at the mess when you eat breakfast and then they get injured by lunchtime. And that sort of stuff over and over, morally, it upsets you. You know what I mean? It challenges you.
You come home then. How do you find your return to Australia?
I found Australia to be fickle, and I found us to have a lot of first world problems, people getting really caught up on things that I found quite trivial. And I did find that really hard to relate to people that weren't military, because my mates and other people that had served were like, yeah, I get what you're talking about. Like, we've just been over here, over to this country, and people are facing life and death every day.
So you're only hanging out with people who had similar experiences?
Yeah.
What about your family? I mean, how did you cope with that?
I think the thing for me is that my family was very military. So my mum, even though she didn't serve, she got it, you know.
Could she see that you had changed?
Yeah, she did. She did.
What did she recognise?
She just sort of saw that I only really had two emotions, which was extreme anger or extreme sadness. I had gone from actually being someone who could be lighthearted to someone who can't be lighthearted. I couldn't just be, just have a joke about something. You know what I mean? I was quite serious and quite aggressive and quite unpredictable with my aggression too.
This idea of hypervigilance, what is hypervigilance? How does it manifest?
Yeah, so I'd describe hypervigilance as something that comes out of an environment where you have had to maintain a level of vigilance for a long time, and being situationally aware is something that they talk about in the military, and it's about always being aware of your surroundings and identifying possible threats.
What does that mean? Someone shuts the door and you get kind of tense?
Or? Yeah, so it's sort of, for me, it was taking a picture of everybody's face and remembering everybody that walked past me. And to be fair, I didn't know why I was doing it. And the other thing was I couldn't sit with my back to an entrance. I had to sit in the corner. And loud noises, if I was in an environment where it was just very chaotic and overpopulated, like if it was really crowded, I just would be stressed sitting there and I'd have to leave.
Eventually, a couple of years later, you decide to leave the army. Mm. What was your dad's reaction to that?
He actually encouraged it. I think I was holding on a little bit too tight to the fact that our family had so much service and I felt a lot of responsibility to try and stay in, but I could see that I wasn't giving it my best. And I think my dad could see that, and he sort of said, listen, I think you need to do what's best for you, and I think you need to get out and find something else. And I started going, no, I need to find a solution to this, because so many people go, well, I don't want to put my hand up because I don't want to stand out. And I don't want people to judge me for maybe being weak or for having a problem with something that other people might not. And I don't want to be that person. So I'll just push on.
Did you feel weak?
Yeah, I had a lot of guilt. I had a lot of guilt and a lot of shame in the fact that there was something wrong with me. Do you know what I mean? From when I came back from overseas. And I always say about things like service that individual experiences may vary. And there are some people that go through life and they can experience the same thing that you do and it doesn't affect them the same way. But I sort of saw at that stage that I had failed, because why did I have a problem? Because my job wasn't like other people's jobs. I wasn't infantry. You know, a lot of people can relate with front line. Counterinsurgency doesn't have a front line. It's everywhere. That's what, you know, that's how insurgents work. But a lot of people, particularly when I put my hand up, they were sort of like, but you weren't front line. So why do you have a problem? Do you know what I mean? And I was kind of like, oh, I'm not sure. Obviously, I, you know, so that I felt like that was a poor reflection on me. But as I said before, what I sort of have what resonated with me was when I heard about moral injury, because my I didn't have that. You know, I wasn't crawling around the ground. You know, you hear stories of Vietnam veterans crawling around the ground. They can't hear fans, and that gives them flashbacks, and then they go to ground and they do all these different things. I didn't have that. That wasn't how I felt, and I didn't have fear of being shot at or anything like that. It was just like certain situations and crowds and things like that would make me feel really anxious, and so, or I'd get really depressed, or I felt like I had no purpose anymore once I got out of the army. So it was really hard for me to put my finger on it, and that added to the shame, I think, and the guilt. Yeah.
Is there a hierarchy of service? I mean, you're saying, you know, people who are in the front line somehow feel that that's more acceptable from the general public, that that's a danger.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you're saying. It's interesting. Since I've started working in the horsemanship program, I have a lot of RAF and Navy guys, and they suffer. These guys suffer too. And I had a person say to me from the Navy, they said to me personally, they said, you know, I don't know how I feel funny about saying I have PTSD or issues from my service because I didn't go to Afghanistan like you did. And I thought, isn't that funny that someone's coming to me saying that when I used to say that to other people? So it doesn't really matter. I learned from that. It doesn't matter that hierarchy that you're talking about. You know, it's definitely there. I see a lot of people that think, oh, my experiences weren't as bad as other people's. But what I've learned is that if it's significant for you, it's significant. Do you know what I mean? And the way for you to move forward and the way for you to get healing isn't by comparing yourself to other people. It's about you getting that help. So, yeah, there definitely is a bit of, I think, people put it on themselves, and it's sad because it gets in the way of them finding help, I believe. Yeah.
Now, I don't know how anyone who hasn't had any kind of service understands. I guess the general public don't understand. But Wayne and Penny, how did you meet Wayne and Penny?
Yeah, so when I wanted to try and find alternate therapies, I was just clicking around looking at stuff, and I found horses. And then I saw horsemanship was like the way that you work with a horse. And obviously with my dog experience and stuff, I thought, oh, okay. So I was looking for equine therapy, but I couldn't find anyone. And then I saw horsemanship. So I did a Google search for horsemanship in my area down in Sydney, and I found Wayne and Penny Austin. So I called them. And I got Wayne, and I said, oh, g'day, you know, this is my story. I'm a veteran, and I'm trying to get into horses as a bit of a therapy, and you know, I'm hoping to get some lessons because I don't really want to do equine therapy, but I want to learn about horses. And he said, mate, you know, he was very appreciative of my service, and he said, you're welcome to come down, and the best way for you to learn about horses is just to be around them, and I'll help you out. I said, okay, how much will that be? And he said, no, just come to my place and you can help out. He said, I don't give lessons anymore. We don't teach people anymore, but I have a racing stable and I train thoroughbreds, and you're welcome to come down and just see what it's about and learn along the way.
What did that feel like being around horses?
It was nerve-wracking at first. I was sort of taken back by their size, particularly a race-fit thoroughbred. He looks like a bodybuilder, and he's like shredded and very athletic looking. They've got a real presence about them. So it was really, really moving to be around them. Yeah.
What did it feel like when Wayne said that to you to come down? I mean, what did that offer from Wayne and Penny mean to you?
I found it hard to accept. I found it very hard to accept because I was like, no, you're providing me with a service, or you're doing something for me. I have to do something back. And Wayne said, no, mate. No, I don't want anything in return. I just want to help you out, you know. And I found that extremely humbling, but really hard to accept. And I used to do fencing. I used to be like, okay, I'll do some fencing. What work do you need done? And it got to a point where he just said to me, listen, are you here to learn about horses, or do you want to keep fencing? you know what I mean? He's like, you know, the time that you're spending here fencing, you're not out doing the stuff that you want to do. Like, you want to learn about horses, go be with horses, mate.
Was it hard to look after yourself? And was it hard to actually accept that you needed help?
I think so. Yeah, 100%. You know, at that time I was about 27, and, yeah, I was still a 20-year-old that had a bit of a chip on his shoulder and thought he was bulletproof, and didn't want to accept that I went through a hard time. You know, I wasn't focused on getting a diagnosis or, you know, getting medical treatment. I just wanted to get over it. I wanted to get past it. And so that was really, yeah, that was my, it was hard for me to accept that. Yeah.
This idea of the ex-racehorses, those who are being retired, the thoroughbred is bred and trained to run fast. They've got this instinct to compete and be tough at what they're doing. I mean, the parallels are very clear, aren't they?
Yeah.
Soldiers are trained in that same way.
Yeah. Wayne and Penny, obviously, working with them, I got a good exposure to the life of a thoroughbred, and they are very well loved and very well kept. But their life is quite institutionalized because they work off the clock and they're regimented in the way that, you know, they eat and work and then they go back and they'll go into a yard and then they'll go out and do some work on the walker in the afternoon or whatever. And they're an athlete, right? And soldiers and anyone that's served, they have a very similar, you know, you get up, you go and you do your training and then you eat and then you go back to work. And it's a structured sort of routine. And so, you know, horses that come off the track or horses that you'll see on properties, they don't live that. A normal horse doesn't live that sort of lifestyle. So they are different and they like to have a job. They like work. And yeah.
You're working with the Thoroughbred and Veteran Welfare Alliance. How did you meet a bloke named Scott Brody?
Yeah, so Scott Brody was told to me by Penny, Penny Austin, and she said, look, there's this guy who's retraining thoroughbreds off the track and he works with veterans. So I called him up and I said, hey, mate, I'm a veteran. I've actually bought a horse and I'm trying to find someone to help me and I want to learn about this. And he said, well, mate, come down. So, I went down to meet Scott and he's a ex-mounted police officer. And his off-sider, Bill Adam, is also a mounted cop. They were mounted police officers. So I found a lot of likeness to them. They were both guys that were professional athletes. They're very motivated, driven guys.
And what did you start doing with them?
Well, they started teaching me horsemanship.
I get this image of you looking into the eyes of a horse. What is that like for you? What does it do for you?
Something that I found straight away was that if I was a bit anxious or aggressive, feeling aggressive, well, you know, when you're just a bit stressed out, the horse looks at you and goes, nah, and they'll back up. They'll start backing up. They don't want to be with you, right? Mm. So when you're working with them, if you can't lie to a horse, you can't hide how you're feeling from a horse. They can see exactly how you feel through their own, you know, senses and things like that. They're incredibly good at reading people. So when you look into the eyes of a horse or when you're in front of a horse, you start seeing what's going on inside for you.
Because, inside you?
Yeah.
And inside the horse?
No, inside you. They start reading that and like I said before, they might walk backwards or they might be completely calm with you because if you're calm, they're calm and they might come up to you and be very connected with you. So the more present you can be in that moment and the more calm and relaxed you can be in the moment, the better influence you have over them. So that's a pretty powerful thing when you're someone that was just overcome with aggression all the time. Yeah.
Have you seen people change through this therapy?
Yeah.
In what way?
Yeah. So I work with a guy at the moment who is really quite hard to communicate with, and he found it really hard to communicate as well. But the more that I've got him to work with things with the horses, like being assertive with them or being receptive of what they're telling him and how he can be more relaxed to help them feel comfortable, his psychologist and his psychiatrist have suggested that they take him back off some medication because he doesn't need it anymore. So I've seen guys that have previously had a lot of social anxiety and depression and things like that become so much more in tune with themselves and develop insights into themselves that help them reintegrate into society and be in social situations.
You use the term de-soldiering. What do you mean by de-soldiering?
Yeah, so sometimes I'll talk about de-soldiering or unsoldiering, and that is just a term really. I define that as you know, that process when you're at Kapuka that we spoke about, that is a step-by-step systematic process in making you go from being an individual to a soldier. And the soldier has to think about the team and the soldier has to think about worst-case scenarios and they learn what-ifs and they learn how to analyze situations. And they're amazing tools and things like that, but they can really lead you astray when you're not in a situation that requires you to be a soldier. So when you're in Civilian Street and you're walking down the street, you don't need to remember that person's face. You don't need to worry about that noise that just went off. You don't, do you know what I mean? You don't need to worry about those sorts of things. And when something occurs in your life, you don't need to go to a catastrophic plan in case that happens. Do you know what I mean? And that's what a lot of people fall into. And I fell into that as well, on just, you know, one thing would go wrong and then I'd just take it a few steps further just in case that happened. And that gets extremely exhausting.
Well, you don't feel safe by the sounds of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But working with horses brings you a sense of safety, a sense of security.
So basically what we're doing is we're getting a horse that maybe it doesn't, particularly with these thoroughbreds, they have this heightened sense all the time and they're quite sensitive to everything. And so we getting veterans to take these horses and help them be comfortable in new environments and teach them new ways of going. So rather than just going flat out all the time, we help them to understand they can walk or they can trot and they can work in a different frame. They can do different things.
Who's training who though?
Well, that's it. It's a bit of a, you know, I sort of would describe it as an indirect method to a direct problem. So it's about taking someone away from their environment that stresses them out and putting them in a new one. And then they get this reflection of themselves through this horse. And the better that they get at helping that horse assimilate and integrate, the better they start to work it out for themselves. It's this crazy sort of experience that is really hard to put into words sometimes.
Tell me about the type of training you're doing with horses.
I don't necessarily follow an equine therapy method. And I think that's it's an interesting point, because equine therapy is focused around therapy and they just use horses to help them communicate and understand a little bit. But we are training and educating a horse, and that is about that developing a connection and a trust and a bond with the horse. But what you will find is that through that process, the horse will highlight those suppressions that you have and the things that you're holding inside that are actually getting in the way of you two becoming one together, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then so by coaching that person to work with that horse, they start to overcome those things in their own way.
It sounds like a wonderful program. Thank you so much for sharing your story today and for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
My guest on Conversations today has been Isaac Adams. You can find out more about Isaac's program, Healing with Horsemanship, at our website. If this conversation has raised any issues for you, help and support is always available. The number for Beyond Blue is 1300 22 46 36. Or if you'd prefer, you can chat to them at their website, beyondblue.org.au. I'm Wesley Enoch. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey, I'm Benjamin Law.
And I'm Beverly Wang, and we're the co-hosts of the ABC podcast, Stop Everything.
Now, if you love a good chat, which is a very strong possibility since you've just finished Conversations,
come and join us over on Stop Everything, because every week, Ben and I talk through what's making news in the world of pop culture.
So if you've ever wanted to know the backstory of why a celebrity is apologising, what they're apologising for, and why it might not be quite landing, or the reasons why a particular meme is cropping up all over your social feed and how it's a sign of the times, then Stop Everything is for you.
Ben and I talk to each other, but we also talk to some of the most exciting creators, thinkers, and observers of screen, audio, and online culture. We get deep into how and why pop culture reflects and affects the world.
That's Stop Everything with me, Benjamin Law.
And me, Beverly Wang. Follow Stop Everything now on the ABC Listen app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.